So we have gone through many of the various technical documents related to Project Mogul and some of the other work that you and Dr. Spielhouse and others have done with the constant altitude balloon projects. And according to Dr. Spielhouse, he said that you would be the technical expert as it related to those types of projects, as in terms of the materials involved, the instrumentation, that sort of thing. Is that a pretty accurate statement?
I think that's correct.
If I could, what I'd like to do is just kind of run through some questions that we have.
Would it make it easier if we moved to the dining room table? Since you have all this and have papers to lay out, you might just like to
Okay.
Put things on the
sir.
Table. That might be more useful for you to work.
Of course, what we're really here for is to discuss this that came out in the newspaper and the General Accounting Office's investigation of how we deal with records, the acquisition, and ultimately disposition. There is an allegation that the government is involved in a conspiracy and cover-up of something that occurred in 1947, which is the allegation of there being some sort of flying disc, flying saucer, UFO, what have you.
That's correct.
And of course, the people who put out things such as this journal, MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, the books that have been written by William Moore and Randall and Schmidt and others, a lot of the popular television shows, they've just exacerbated the situation where a lot of things, quotations, some of your quotations taken out of context. One of the individuals, Sheridan Cavett, who at that time was a counterintelligence corps officer at Roswell Army Airfield, who actually went out with Jesse Marcel to recover some material that has been alleged to be the results of a UFO, which Colonel Sheridan, he specifically states, looked like a weather balloon to him.
Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
I'm aware that he had been there, but I had understood that other quotations had been attributed to him.
Yes, sir. And as we go through this, I believe I've got a copy of essentially a statement that he made to Colonel Weaver, whom you've talked with also. Colonel Weaver talked with Sheridan Cavett 2 weeks ago.
I see.
And so a lot of the statements that have been attributed to Sheridan Cavett, he says that they're taken out of context. He refutes a lot of the information that appears in these various books. So, what I'd like to do, even though this is out of a popular UFO type of magazine, is there are some statements attributed to individuals concerning the material that was found, supposedly by Mac Brazell, somewhere northwest of Roswell, New Mexico. They talk in terms of materials that look like metallic foil, and specifically that could not be bent or broken. As we've gone through the various research, what we believe to be Project Mogul was probably involved in this incident. And the materials that were being used in Mogul, of course, included not only the polyethylene balloons, but included the neoprene balloons at some point, the various types of radar reflectors, the instrumentation that was being used. Is there any type of material from that project that you can think of that would be pliable, would be bendable, but you know, could not be torn? Could any of the polyethylene or the foil-like radar reflectors, could that be the case.
Let me get a picture for you. I have... This is a radar reflector that was manufactured in 1953. It's the ML307C.
Okay, which is a little different from the B model that was used in 1947.
Where this looks like a pine stick, the material on the ones we had, this was all balsa and somewhat smaller in diameter. But the configuration, with one exception, this configuration of corners, snaps right across here. These corners were the same thing. Here's a picture of this sort of target being used in 1948, and you can see we are launching multiple targets beneath this balloon.
Now, is this the same type of target as this, or is this the B model?
This is the B model we flew. We flew in 1947 and 1948, but those are pictures of the B model. And if you look faintly along here, you can see a sort of a discoloration, and that's where my memory of the reinforcing tape was that they talked about. The B models, as I remember, did not have these three veins up here, and you don't see particularly any suggestion in when. In other photographs, I have them. I don't remember these, which would make the thing rotate and fight. This in the B models was more like an aluminum foil with a heavy laminated paper. So the material they talked about, I think, was derived from some version of this.
Now they talk in terms of the material being able to crumple it and then releasing it, and it would unfold by itself and not leave any creases. This material looks like, you know, that it would almost be like aluminum foil, would crease and remain creased.
Well, it does have this paper laminate, and the paper, I think, was maybe a bit tougher on the earlier thing. But I have no explanation for the fact that it couldn't be bent with a sledgehammer, as one of the people said.
Burned.
And it couldn't be burned. Well, I think some of the balsa wood was dipped in something like Elmer's glue, and as a result had some sort of glue coating on it, which would make it somewhat resistant to burning.
I know Colonel Weaver's discussions with Sheridan Cabot, they talked about the aspect of burning. He did not recall burning anything, but then his wife indicated that there had been one night they'd been out and had a barbecue and had a few beers, and that Jesse Marcel just took a piece and stuck it in the barbecue and then pulled it back out. So if that's what they're using to say it wouldn't burn, that's not what we consider, you know, typically testing the material for burning or not.
Well, I need to say here, and you need to qualify everything I say, the memory of almost 50 years ago.
Yes, sir, I understand that.
And I will say things that are to the best of my memory, but on the other hand, should other evidence indicate my memory is faulty, I readily accept that. So I'll state things to the best of my memory, but I have a memory that there was something like Elmer's glue. There was a problem in attaching this to the paper that was behind.
What, going back to the reinforcing tape and things, there were discussions concerning unusual symbols and almost like hieroglyphics. Purple, pinkish in nature, that sort of thing.
I don't know if I sent Colonel Weaver a copy of the sketch.
No, we did not see that.
But Robert Todd, who's been a person very interested in trying to get to the truth of this, asked me to make a sketch of what I remember. And a couple of years ago, or a year or so ago, I made this sketch, and this is my memory of what was there. I do remember every time I prepared one of these targets for flight, I always wondered why these figures were on the tape. It was always a question why they were there. And when this purplish, pink marking on the debris came up, I immediately remembered this sort of marking. And other people, I have a letter here from one of my technicians who said, oddly, he remembers the same markings. And you perhaps have talked to Albert Trakowski.
We have tried to reach Colonel Trakowski, and he has not returned our calls. We've left messages on his answering machine, and there's been no response.
Well, he may be out of town. I did visit him last October, and he made a point that he was our project officer. He and I were served together under Colonel Duffy in the Air Force Liaison Office in 1943 I went overseas in 44. But Trakowski stayed and took a commission in the Air Force when it was offered, and was the project officer on Mogul. I have paperwork here from General LeMay's files, in which after the war a number of people were to be sent overseas because they'd not had overseas duty. And there is a history of Colonel Trakowski. Perhaps you have it from the Pentagon files already, from the AG files.
We have some records, yes.
From him. Well, I have a further discussion. Anyway, Albert Trakowski was the Watson Laboratory project officer on this. And when I raised this question to him, he said, well, he had talked to John Peterson, one of Colonel Duffy's procurement man, and they were joking about these markings on the tape. And I have a letter that I can give you a copy of, in which I quote Trakowski in saying, what do you expect when you have your targets made by a toy factory in Manhattan?
So essentially the original targets were made by a toy company.
It's either a toy company or a garment manufacturer in the garment district in Manhattan, or it was by a novelty company. I've talked to Ed Istvan, who was another one of the Air Force Liaison Office people who stayed in, and Istvan lives in your area, and I can give you documentation on these things. Istvan said that it was some outfit that extruded toothpaste tubes, and he got involved with them because they made radar chaff. In the early days of this effort, there were a number of different targets made. I see I may have or not don't have them here. I have them downstairs. There were a number of different forms of targets were made. One idea was just inside of a meteorological balloon to put radar chaff and adhere it with glycerin. Just put glycerin, wet the inside of the balloon with glycerin, and then shake in dipoles cut to the proper half wavelength. And when the balloon is inflated, these would be all on the inside.
Just kind of coating the inside.
The inside of the balloon. And this didn't give nearly the sort of target that the corner reflector gave. But anyway, Istvan initially went to New York hunting for a source of supply and came across the company.
Jim, is that name coming for you?
Much of which we can copy and make it easier for you. These are balloon fragments, things how balloons look after they've been exposed to the sun.
Now, is this the neoprene type?
It's the neoprene type. I have the polyethylene type.
Now, is this from the 47 era?
That's a balloon probably from the 50s. That's a KSAM balloon, the kind of balloon we used then were the Dewey and Almy Derricks balloons, and that's the way they look after they've been out in the sun. So that's about 3 weeks exposure to sunlight here in New Mexico.
So the polyethylene really is degraded by sunlight.
That's neoprene.
This is neoprene also.
Bear with me while I fish down.
This almost looks like ashes of paper.
That's right. There's a big point in some of the recovery that the material was black. Let's see.
You're looking for that one, are you?
No, I have that, but I'm really looking for the list of addresses and telephone numbers. Curry's there, eh? Okay, here is the list of the people who were assigned under Colonel Duffy in the Air Force Liaison Office, and Istvan's name you'll find in there. He ended up being in the Titan program, and I think retired as a lieutenant colonel, maybe back in the 70s.
Yes, Schneider.
Schneider was the administrative director of our project. He and I worked together. And he lives in Maine and was not really technically involved. And I have letters on him if you're interested in seeing him. He says he has no memory of this. The person who was heavily involved in developing this whole radar thing was Joe Fletcher. Have you talked to Joe
Colonel
Fletcher?
Colonel Fletcher?
Colonel Fletcher.
Yeah. No, we haven't.
I have a letter. I wrote him a letter asking for his help, and he essentially says he doesn't remember much. But
he's also been hounded by some of these UFO.
And by Todd and by me.
So it appears as though you yourself have done some extensive research into this particular incident.
Well, until 2 years ago, I was quite convinced one of our polyethylene balloons that we didn't recover caused it. And then I got this newspaper, Todd sent me this, and I immediately saw there's no way that could be a polyethylene balloon.
Now, the only question I had for you on this was W.W. Brazell mentions islets. Which appear in the reflector.
Sorry.
Now, there's also on the polyethylene balloons that the shroud, however you had it hooked on there, there's eyelets around the base.
There was
a ring at the neck of the balloon, and then there was attach points to that ring, were there not?
But there were no eyelets.
No eyelets. I believe that there were. I've reviewed the New York University documents, and there's a very clear depiction in one of them of eyelets.
Well, okay, that I'm thinking of the later. Here is the general. Here are the NYU reports, the originals of them.
In one of the configurations, they clearly show eyelets in the drawing. But going back to Brazell, you state that you think it could not be one of the polyethylene balloons. He indicates in this newspaper article that that he actually found the debris in mid-June, but however, it didn't subsequently come out until July. So the
Yeah, you're right. Okay, that is in one of the polyethylene balloons. You're correct. You're right. I fall back on my plea that my memory isn't.
Yeah, it comes into depending on what Brazell was speaking about.
Okay, there are clearly eyelets here, and there's even a little
it's like a swivel type thing.
But he talks about
smoky gray rubber, which obviously these samples here would, as you say, if they've only been out for a short time, a matter of days, smoky gray. That's a very good description of what they look like.
And actually, when you just first retrieve it, it has a bad odor, and people talked about there being a burned odor.
Right.
We need to talk about these neoprene balloons because they came in different.
That's the eye.
Sorry.
That's the eye.
There were two manufacturers. One, Dewey and Almy in Cambridge, manufactured with a dip process, and they looked very much had very much the appearance, if you will, of a condom. They were an ivory colored gel, whereas the KSM company in Patterson made a cast neoprene emulsion into a mold, and then they inflated the mold, and they had to put a lot of plasticizer so they could take this wet gel and inflate it, and make it into a meteorological balloon. This is a KSAM balloon here, which I think is not a good candidate.
KSAM was
K-A, it was a guy named Sam Kay formed a company, and he was called KSAM, K-A-Y-S-A-M. In fact, I have, and you're welcome to them, KSAM balloons, because of the way they were made, and this gel that had to be inflated, had this ring, cardboard ring put in them. That's a neck of a KSAM balloon. And here are more modern KSAM balloons that are still being flown.
So these are just used for the typical meteorological type balloons.
Correct.
Radio sounds.
Carry radio sounds, that's correct. Dewey Naomi's gone out of the business, and KSAM bought them out. And here's a KSAM balloon that is made to made by dip mold. And this is somewhat indicative, I think, of the way one of those balloons of the type we were using. As you can see on exposure to just to ordinary light, they discolor. But these are balloons that were made probably in the 70s. And as they change with plasticizer and antioxidants for ozone, they certainly change in appearance. The balloons I have pictures here. Pictures in the hangar. As you can see, that these are the ivory-colored balloons of the sort we were flying. This is the balloon that you just found the eyelets on. In the hangar, later picture. But there we're preparing to launch. These are pictures from the 1947 era, where we're getting ready to fly the 15-foot H.A. Smith balloon.
Now the reinforcing tape on these balloons, these polyethylene balloons, we were told it was a type of acetate. It had none of this symbology, is that
none
correct?
None of it at all.
So the symbology on the tape was only related to the radar reflectors.
That's correct. Here is a later model polyethylene balloon, and it's a little thinner than the ones we were flying, but there's a polyethylene balloon.
Looks like polyethylene sheeting that I would use to cover up a paint room.
I've also heard the early balloons described as carrot bag quality. Material they would use in a carrot bag. Would that be close?
Certainly looks like it.
Dry cleaner bags.
Dry cleaner bags. We think of them as being very fragile, but materials from this time frame they have been described as durable. Something that you couldn't tear with your hand, but.
That's about 2 mil polyethylene here.
Yeah, obviously you could tear this.
This was 4 mil, and these balloons that we had on, somewhere here I had these pictures. These balloons here, that's Flight 8. These are the little balloons here that are seen from the air.
From a B-17 or
I think C-54? This was C-45. I think.
Okay.
We did indeed have B-17 attached to us and C-54s, but I think this was trying to chase Flight 8 down, and this was one of the candidate flights that I thought might have been until 2 years ago. I thought might have been an explanation for what occurred.
Why do you think, why did you change your mind at that point?
That newspaper report right there.
Okay, because of him saying that he actually found the material in mid-June?
No, because he said it was balsa sticks and smoky rubber.
Okay.
And had those curious markings on the on that, because that's a very vivid memory I have of these markings on the radar targets we flew.
Did you ever, you said you often wondered why those markings were on there. Had you ever resolved that for yourself?
Only with what Albert Krakowski told me, that our friend John Peterson, the procurement A man was just joking, what else do you expect when you have your targets made by a toy factory? These, let me go back if I may. Colonel Duffy was assigned to extract meteorological equipment out of the Signal Corps in 1943. There was a great argument that went on between the Army Air Force and the Signal Corps. The Signal Corps didn't want to let any meteorological equipment out until he thought it was perfect. At the same time, General Arnold was expanding for a global war and was trying to get meteorological equipment all around the earth. And so Colonel Duffy got assigned to expedite the equipment. And he, as various of us graduated from the meteorological cadet schools, he took those of us with engineering backgrounds and assigned us to bird dog various things within the Signal Corps engineering laboratories. And I got assigned ended up with some appendicitis and got pulled off of an overseas shipment. And while I was recovering, I got assigned to prepare this manual that Colonel Duffy, he was unhappy with the rate at which signal manuals were coming out, so he wanted a loose leaf arrangement to send things out. So I got assigned to prepare this manual. And at the same time, then Captain Fletcher was assigned to, Duffy had heard that weather was giving trouble to radar. And so Colonel Duffy just turned it around and said, gee, you mean radar can pick up weather? And ended up with Captain Fletcher being assigned to both convert this for looking at storm clouds and also to make wind measurements. There was a big problem. The Weather Bureau prior to World War II determined upper winds merely by releasing a pilot balloon, following it with a theodolite, estimating the rate of rise, and then from the elevation and azimuth angles and the assumed height after a certain time to calculate what the winds were.
Is that the Beaufort scale? Or?
Well, Beaufort was the Navy. That was the Navy.
It's like taking a pieball reading now.
Exactly. In fact, it was called a pieball then, and it is now. And Colonel Duffy pushed very heavily to get electronic means for measuring winds aloft. There were two approaches, one use of radar targets and the SCR 584, with which you may be familiar.
One of the receivers, early receivers.
The early gun-laying radar, and Colonel Duffy talked to the field artillery that was procuring through the Signal Corps a gun-laying radar, the SCR 584, which is, let's see, that's this radar right here.
Yes, we've seen that photo before.
All right, this is Spillhouse's book. And so Fletcher and Fletcher ended up with a whole bunch of his own second lieutenants around. There was Judd Tibbett, from whom I have a photograph showing an earlier model target, the A model target. Istvan was one. There were a bunch of them listed. This, incidentally, is for, this listing here is for you if you'd like to have it.
Yes, thank you.
Anyway, Tibbetts ended up being the big installer of radar and in fact was assigned down to the Tularosa range camp to make wind measurements for the Trinity shot, the test in 1945. And as far as I know, that was the first time these targets had been used in New Mexico. And he used the Tibbetts, who until recently lived in Albuquerque. He's now moved to Scottsdale, Arizona. Tibbetts says that he did not ever fly this kind of target in New Mexico, which will be of interest to you when they talk about substitute, that people should have known what a target looked like.
Right. There were discussions concerning having radar targets, but supposedly the B model and subsequent models were brand new, had never flown anything like that in this area.
According to Tibbetts, the B model got to, the A model was had a big aerodynamic drag. It was a flat plane of aluminum foil and had two triangle triangle coming down. It made a corner reflector, but the B model, the A model looked like, and then across here was that, and then there was a, this is one surface, this is another surface, right. And this is yet another, and they were held by strings from these four corners. And obviously trying to take something that's almost a meter in cross-section, a meter on a side, take it sideways up through, gave a lot of drag, and it took a lot of lift for the balloon to make the balloons rise very rapidly. And so instead, somebody came up with this smart idea of this other arrangement of the corner reflector that had much less drag. And these, according to Tibbetts, weren't distributed until something like November of 1945. And as far as I know, there were no, as you will see in the various correspondence, there were no SCR 584s, which were required to track them, issued to the weather services here in New Mexico. And obviously after Trinity site, after the Trinity shot, there was no big meter, no big military operation that required wind determination in New Mexico.
So essentially, you'd say that there were no radar reflectors in New Mexico in 1947 until this appeared?
That's my opinion.
Okay. The other question is that who, apparently, you say Major Pritchard. Was Major Pritchard operating, doing any kind of balloon project?
No, he and Dyved and others were at Watson Laboratories. I understand from Tchaikovsky that Alamogordo Army Airfield was about to be closed down as surplus. And the people at Watson Laboratories seized on it and were able to keep it on active status for two projects. One, the radar project from Watson Laboratories that was to track, that were set to track the V-2s being flown from the proving ground across the Tularosa Valley, and Project Mogul. I joined the NYU group in January of 47, and immediately, and while I was finishing up at Georgia Tech, I had talked to my chemical engineering professors about, I'd already been recruited by Duffy and Spillhouse, and I asked, well, if you wanted to make a balloon of non-extensible material, what plastic would you use? And my professor named Grubb told me, well, you ought to consider polyethylene. It's a new plastic just now becoming available, and it has some, you can heat seal it. It has a lot of desirable properties. And so as soon as I got to NYU, I began talking to everybody I could find in Manhattan, DuPont, all the sales offices.
Yeah, we saw your listing in that.
Right. I was concerned with where we could get the plastic and who we could get to manufacture them, manufacture the balloons. We were, I was in my 20s, just a recent graduate. I knew nothing about manufacturing, but we did try to get a manufacturing company that would fabricate balloons for us. And during that period, we heard of the Navy project that was going on at General Mills, where Jean Picard was planning to make a flight to 100,000 feet. And General Mills at that time was making balloons out of a Goodyear film called Plyofilm. And it was a vinyl chloride that just went to hell.
Exposed to sunlight.
It really came apart. And so we, I'm very proud that we began pushing them for polyethylene balloons. And with some difficulty, we got Otto Winsen, who was the entrepreneur and promoter working with Picard. And we got him to make these balloons you see here. In the design that what was being planned for Project Helios with the plyofilm balloons. And at the same time, we got somebody, an entrepreneur who was even faster acting, and that was this fellow H.A. Smith.
It was kind of a one-man shop.
A one-man shop, and he would do anything for money. And he indeed did. He, with no great technical background, he made a number of these balloons for us.
It was kind of a garage type of an affair where he would sit down and just make them one by one. And
I don't know. You know, he got some girls and got some assembly workers and for a contract from us. We got these balloons going. Made visits to Minneapolis to push General Mills. The pressure from the Air Force was enormous. There was a similar problem, of course, in developing microphones that would pick up low frequency sound waves with Columbia, and there was much enthusiasm in testing these microphones.
The question I have for you: the question is, when you were Army Air Force. How did you come to join the Army Air Force? Track everything back.
When World War II broke out, I applied for pilot training, and so did everybody else. And because I was a senior at Georgia Tech in a chemical engineering course with a fair amount of thermodynamics and other things, I got diverted into the meteorological cadet program. I still wanted to be a pilot, but I got diverted into the meteorological cadet program, and the next class that I could join didn't start until December of 42. I joined up sometime in 42, and so I went through the meteorological cadet program and found I was a lousy forecaster, but I did end up Spillhouse came recruiting for people with engineering background. I got recruited into Colonel Duffy's liaison office.
And was that directly for General Arnold's staff? You understand?
I was assigned, believe it or not, to headquarters Army. I still have the headquarters Air Force roundels.
The round one?
Yeah, I have it.
Okay.
I ended up being assigned to headquarters Air Force, Army Air Force.
And what rank were you at that time?
I was a second lieutenant.
Okay. And you got recruited by right. At that time Lieutenant Colonel Spillhouse.
Well, by that time Captain Spillhouse.
Captain Spillhouse.
Right.
Okay.
And I got sent to the Weather Equipment Technician School in Spring Lake, New Jersey.
Okay.
Essentially Fort Monmouth.
Right.
And then when I finished the training course for radiosonde and for maintenance of equipment, I was headed to North Africa. And I had a medical problem, and when I got out of the hospital, I was assigned back to Colonel Duffy. And I remained there. I finished this manual in 44. I was commissioned in September 43, finally, and then finished the school in November, was assigned to write this manual, which was finished in the summer of 44, and then I got an assignment to China. And so I left.
Dr. Spillhouse?
No, I went ahead. I ended up being the weather equipment officer for CBI.
Okay.
And then Spillhouse came over later. He came over at that time the war was going very much better. And Spillhouse and Duffy they had a long range storm detection system, the spheric system,
right.
The predecessor of what's used now for lightning detection here.
Storm scopes.
The storm scopes and the LLP, if you're familiar with LLP, the lightning location system.
Used by the Weather Service.
And we have one of the stations here on campus, and we actually have if you're later on, we'll go over and show you, we have a map of the lightning strokes over the entire U.S. as they occur. We have a readout right here. In our laboratory.
So you were doing that work in China?
Spillhouse came over to with a, it was called the Spherics Net, as it was called,
right.
and got a station installed in Chanting, China, and to work, of course, for the bombing of Japan. And so Spillhouse came over, I think summer '45 was when he came over. We had the SCR-658s, we had a number of them
that were being installed. We had one up in Yunnan and in the communist area. We had several of them in China for getting good wind measurements. And the Spillhouse had been involved in that, and I think by 45 it was clear that things would be over relatively soon. Not as we thought we'd be back in 48, but in any event, he got an assignment over to 10th Weather in the summer of 45 and came over.
Right. So when at what point did you ever hear the term long range detection?
That's a good question. I didn't know the name MOGO until Robert Todd told me 2 years ago. I never heard the name MOGO, if the classification was that high. I knew what we were doing. And when Helgoland was exploded in April of 47, we had balloons in the air. We launched balloons out of the, I guess, Watson Laboratory. Well, it was actually Eatontown.
Eatontown, right.
What had been the Eatontown Signal Laboratory, but I think was now Watson Laboratory. But in any event, we launched a string of balloons. Even though we didn't have constant level balloons, we still carried microphones aloft. And a C-54 orbited overhead and followed the balloons out to sea. And I have no idea about the results they got.
Did you number that balloon flight?
No, we didn't.
Not a letter or a number?
Wait a minute. I don't know. The answer is I don't know.
Would it, if you did give it a letter or a number, would it be on this?
See, we were trying to. There were some of these flights that appeared to have no sequence number. They were talking in terms of being service flights, and the impression that we got were that the service flights were either test flights just to check the balloons out, or they were the high to classified flights where.
Right.
Where the information was not being logged into essentially an unclassified document.
Well, you notice that Flight 1 was made from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
The football field.
Pardon?
The football field there?
The football field. Yeah. Lehigh, exactly. That's where we did it, from the football field. And we did this because a professor at NYU had just gone to head up the physics department at Lehigh, and he invited us over. His name was Frank Butler, keeps coming to my mind. I'm not sure that's the right name, but in any event, we went there, and that was for an early attempt for Helgoland. I think the Helgoland explosion got scrubbed, but we had balloons in the air from it, from this, and we were woefully not ready. We had all sorts of problems. We adopted the balloon technique that a cosmic ray investigator at NYU, a fellow named Sergei Korf. We adopted his technique, and we had a lot to learn. We got our hands torn up with nylon line being pulled through it as we couldn't hold the balloons down in the wind.
Now, speaking of nylon line, were these braided type lines, or were they monofilament type of lines?
Neither. They were, I think initially we used either parachute cord, which was braided. I don't remember the details what we used, but we rapidly learned that the radiosonde cord we used was not strong enough at all to hold the forces that came, and so we went to what was called lobster twine. We used a lot of lobster twine, which was a twisted, a laid line that was used in lobster nets.
Do you recall ever there having been some sort of monofilament, you know, similar to the monofilament fishing line in any of the projects?
I think it was not available at that time. Okay. My memory, the answer is yes, we've used an awful lot of monofilament. We use it now all the time.
But at that time, you don't think it was available?
I think it was not available.
Would the early nylon line, would it have degraded, such as the balloon material degraded and maybe fused in the hot sun?
I doubt it. Okay. If we had any, it would have been white, which would have been a high albedo, would not have absorbed a lot of sunlight.
So yeah, there were discussions about what appeared to be unbraided or unstranded fiber-type lines. It's been alluded to that was the precursors to what we use for fiber optics today in the materials that were found. That's why I asked about the monofilament line.
a lot of what we used on the radio, a lot of what we used early was a linen cord, not twisted, and it was about the, it was indeed a brown, a dull brown color, but we because we it was designed just for radio sound balloons, and we rapidly exceeded its strength. So we very quickly, and I don't know when, but we very quickly went over to this twisted lobster twine.
Okay.
The to answer your question, there are three flights that are missing here, 2, 3, and 4, and I've identified flight 4. Flight 4 was a flight we made, and you don't have it there, Lieutenant, but Flight 4 we made in Alamogordo in something like June 2nd or 3rd of 1947. And the reason I have it identified is I have Albert Curry's diary. The scientific end of the group was heavily based from Columbia University. There was Dr. James Peoples, who was an employee of Watson Laboratory, and there was an Albert Curry, who had been a graduate student under Dr. Ewing.
Later was also was an employee of the Watson Laboratory.
Who was then an employee of Watson Laboratory.
Right.
Curry, I have Curry's diary, which...
Is that C-R-A-R-Y?
C-R-A-R-Y. There he is, and here for you is a translation. I don't know if you want to. I'd be glad to make you a copy of it.